This episode of the UAV Digest is sponsored by GoEngineer, provider of design, engineering, and 3D printing solutions for the aerospace and unmanned vehicles industries. To learn more, visit the UAVDigest.com/GoEngineer. You're listening to episode 31 of the UAV Digest. I'm Max Flight in Hartford, Connecticut.
And I'm in Philadelphia, and I'm David Vanderhoof.
Hi, David. Well, of course, a few days ago, we released episode 30, kind of a special episode, which was an audio transcript of the NTSB administrative law judge decision in the case of the FAA v. Rafael Perker. Now, of course, we wanted to give you all listening the option of, well, of listening to what the judge wrote instead of just reading the document. So hopefully some of you found that valuable. David, we're going to talk about that judge's decision and a few other things this episode, aren't we?
Yeah, but that'll be our primary focus. And I do appreciate you taking the time to record that. Hopefully our listeners, if you haven't listen to it, definitely listen to it before we have our conversation tonight, because it is important. And it sure as heck beats reading it, because your eyes would have glazed over reading it. So I'm very impressed that you were able to do that, Max. But I guess the other topics we'll talk about tonight, of course, will be round one was Trappy 1, FAA 0, but round two, the bell just rang. We have an offensive hexacopter, and conservationists look to utilize UAVs. A little more bird watching from above. So, folks, well, Friday the press release came out that the judge threw out the case against Trappy versus the FAA. And the bottom line was that the judge felt that what he was flying was a remote controlled airplane and not a UAV / UAS. So, therefore, the FAA had no jurisdiction, with the implication also that they do not have any rules for proper enforcement. I posted to our Twitter feed a picture of far and away the Nicole Kidman thing with the Oklahoma land grab, where they have all the stagecoaches and horses lined up and the gun goes off and off they go. And we had lots and lots of people applauding and saying, wow, we can now do UAVs and use them for business, etc. It was a great victory until about 24 hours, Max?
Yeah.
That the FAA appealed the ruling.
Yeah, I think a lot of people kind of jumped the gun on this and declared that it was now a time when everyone could engage in commercial drone operations and do all the things that the FAA has been saying that they couldn't. So it's an interesting case, and it's by no means far from over, and that's one of the things we want to talk about. But maybe it's worthwhile just to really briefly kind of recap for those who haven't delved into this that deeply. And this is the situation where Rafael Perker was flying a right-wing Zephyr around the University of Virginia, taking video and being paid for it. I think it was some kind of a promotional endeavor. So the FAA claimed that this constituted commercial operation, and you can't do that. And also that the flying that he was doing endangered life and property. How Trappy was doing some, almost aerobatic kinds of maneuvers, flying through a automobile tunnel and, you know, a few other things that the FAA took issue with. They did fine him $10,000 for that. Perker appealed, and the judge, as David said, dismissed the case. Now, in looking at the ruling, I mean, I find it a very interesting ruling, and it covers kind of a lot of ground, and there are some subtleties in there, but some of the key aspects, I think, are these. Perker was flying a model airplane. The judge said that's a model airplane. that the FAA can go ahead and try and declare it to be a UAS, but that doesn't make it a UAS. It's a model airplane. Now, the judge also said that the FAA has no regulations governing model airplanes. In fact, the FAA has a long history of specifically excluding model airplanes from its regulations. And then finally, the judge said that even if the Zephyr was to be considered a UAS, the FAA has no regulations that govern UAS. The FAA, he said, has policy statements, but those are non-binding on the public. And policy statements do not meet the test of valid regulations. So basically, he said, the FAA's got nothing in this case, and that's why he dismissed it.
The argument that says that a UAS is a, or and really we need to define this even deeper, it's an SUAS or a small UAS, is a radio controlled airplane or close to it, is very interesting. It's an interesting way to look at it. There are a lot of sophisticated radio controlled airplanes, but this aircraft was on the blur line. When does a UAS become a model airplane, or when does a model airplane become a UAS? We've had a lot of people write in say, well, where's the breakdown? And I don't think we know that yet. I know the Academy of Model Aeronautics is working on that definition. One of the things that I say that might be a breakdown is first-person view. I don't know of any radio-controlled airplane that currently is flown by first-person view. I might be wrong. But that seems to be a break in the technology. Radio-controlled airplanes usually are controlled from the ground, line of sight. Something with a first-person view would give the ability to make it a UAS. I guess the ultimate slap in the face for the FAA is the judge came around and said, you really have no rules. You have nothing written down, only a policy statement. And that was the excitement causing throughout the industry and a lot of the people who have been very anti-FAA as far as this consumerism and their delay. So maybe it might strike them to speed up the process to get some actual rules down.
Yeah, and this distinction between a model airplane and a SUAS or a drone or whatever you want to call it is it's going to be an interesting conversation, I think, because hopefully we won't end up with a definition that's technology-based so that whenever the technology changes or advances, then we have to rethink definitions. Whether or not it's got first-person view is kind of seems like kind of a pretty clear line. The thing is, the FAA is used to very clear lines. And, you know, when you talk about an aircraft that has a pilot in it, it's very easy for them to say, okay, you've got a pilot in it or you don't. What's changing here and becoming more difficult is, does it really matter if the pilot is in the craft or not? You know, is that the distinction? And I think maybe that's not a great distinction. You know, for an RC airplane, a radio-controlled airplane, a model airplane that, you know, we would all look at and say, yeah, that's a model airplane, that's easy. But when you start to get into larger, more capable aircraft that can fly at higher altitudes and do other things, does it matter if the pilot is in the plane or on the ground as long as there's a pilot controlling the device? What the FAA cares about, I think, is what could that aircraft do up there, and how do we maintain the safety of the airspace? So it's going to be a very interesting conversation, and I don't know where that line is right now. All we know is the judge has declared that a right-wing Zephyr is a model airplane, but you know that's really all we do have right now.
And as a sidelight, we would love to know what right wing thinks of that decision that their UAV is being called a model airplane.
Right, right.
Not quite really good for your publicity or your but you know even
yeah
bad
the marketing department yeah
yeah.
So the important thing I think in terms of where this goes next is the appeal, and as you mentioned, David, the FAA didn't take very long to say that they were going to appeal this. Now, the appeal process, it's worth spending a few minutes describing because it's fairly interesting. I mean, what we're dealing with here is a case where the FAA has fined someone, and we've already gone through the first step of the appeal process, the first appeal, which is with the NTSB's Office of Administrative Law Judges. And that's the hearing that that we just had. It's a trial without a jury, and the FAA has the burden of proof by a preponderance of the evidence, is what they is how it's termed. And this is what we saw. The second appeal, and this is what will happen next, is to the full board, to the full National Transportation Safety Board. The board it will then issue one of several decisions. Either they will affirm the administrative law judge's decision, they will modify it, or they can reverse it, or they can remand the case back to the judge for further proceedings. So it could go in all those different possible directions. Now, if the NTSB board ruling is further appealed, then there's actually a third step in the appeal process. Then it goes to the U.S. District Court or the U.S. Court of Appeals. So that kind of takes it outside of the FAA / NTSB realm and to a court of law. So that all of that could take a great deal of time. So we may, David, actually not see a resolution of this for quite a while.
So what you're saying is the race is on between whether we'll see a resolution of these court trials or the fact that the FAA will actually make rules?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, which will come first? Good point. That's a good question.
What I really thought was fascinating was the fact that it actually, the FAA reports to the National Transportation Safety Board. The preponderance of evidence actually was on the FAA, and clearly they did not do a good job proving they were in the right. While they've appealed it, I'm wondering how much more evidence or how much of a stronger case they can possibly make against this argument. Somehow along the line, they have to come up with a rule that proves that that's not a radio-controlled airplane, but a UAV. That definition inevitably will make the rule. Then the judge will have the ability to say, well, yeah, but you didn't have it at the time of the fine.
I did find a webpage of Richard T. Miller. He's a specialist in aviation law. And he said in his on his website, and this is a quote, "The standard on appeal is abuse of discretion. And thus the NTSB or the U.S. Court of Appeals are highly deferential to the trial judge."
In pure English, what that means is not often do these appeals up the chain of command ever change. They defer to the original judge who on the case. So there may be appeal, but the odds of it being overturned are, as it goes up, is slim to nil.
That's what it would sound like to me. But we'll see. And, you know, I think that in summary, you know, those who are, you know, taking this or seeing this ruling as a signal that they can go ahead and undertake commercial operations, it's too soon for that. And the other aspect of this is that there are some issues that have yet really to be decided and defined. But, you know, the one part of the ruling, you know, leaving aside the, is it a model airplane or is it a UAS, leaving that aside, the other part of it, though, seems to me like it's pretty definitive, that being that an FAA policy statement is not a regulation. Policy statements are, it can be advice, but they're not binding on the general public. In order to become a regulation, there's a process they have to go through. It has to be subject to review and comment by the public, and none of that has happened yet. So it would seem that the judge's comments that the FAA has got nothing with respect to UAS regulations at this point, I'm thinking that's going to stick.
Well, the other thing is, it's not something we're familiar with. Usually the FAA has regulations, and we weren't around when they had nothing. So
yes.
although we've been doing this podcasting stuff a long time, there's always been rules and regulations, even when the FAA was the CAA. It really should be a warning shot to the FAA that they really need to get their ducks in line, and we got to get some rules down.
Yeah.
I think, though, we'll dovetail this off to one of our listener comments before we go on to our other news stories. And we got a comment from Bill who said, David and Max, this article, and the article was Popular Mechanics, Flying Unmanned Aircraft in the Face of Authority. Hi, David and Max. This article digs a little deeper into that group that Perker belongs to and how and why they operate. I also can't imagine that you can go far, far wrong from next week's video. The week is from one of them. It's one of those pivotal stories that's going to blow up. It talks about Team Black Sheep and a group of pilots, including Trappy, who produced dramatic videos from UAVs. However, the UAVs that they do produce, while he's amazing, are definitely snubbing the nose of the FAA, which the Team Black Sheep does.
Yeah, they're certainly, by all indications, are very skilled at piloting UAVs. And some of the videos they produce show some real, almost aerobatic skill in terms of control. The videos are pretty spectacular. Part of the FAA's charge against Trappy was this sort of reckless endangerment kind of situation. And nothing in the judge's ruling addresses that. And that's the way it should be, because the judge is saying there's some first initial issues that have to be resolved first. And since the FAA doesn't have, in his views, doesn't have purview over this kind of operation, then these other reckless endangerment issues don't come to play. But so that's left open. And yeah, I think, David, to your point, is that, you know, it's nice to demonstrate the skills that you've got and the interesting things that you can do with UAVs, but flying them in ways that could endanger others, flying them over populated areas or over traffic, vehicular traffic, is kind of unwise. Maybe if you're a black sheep pilot and can easily or most of the time maintain control of the craft, that doesn't mean that everybody else who's going to try to fly it like that is going to have the same success. And we really don't want to see accidents happening now before we even get started.
Yeah, the old saying is, just because you can doesn't mean you necessarily should.
Right.
And we had another example of that this week. We had the collapse in Manhattan of the building, and equally as big a story as the collapse of the building was someone was flying a DJI Phantom over the building to videotape it. They say they were doing it so that they could sell the footage to some news things, but New York particularly frowns upon having drones flying over it. And again, his comment was he was using it for a commercial use, but there's no reason not to. But putting that kind of attention and deliberate behaviors is something that, if the FAA isn't going to rule, again, we said this multiple times, that we definitely need our industry. And I think you, Max, you and I both sort of feel part of this industry now, that we need to provide our own rules and regulations so we don't get the bad rap, because God forbid somebody's actually flying a really good pilot, but something still can go wrong. And we really don't like the quadcopter that went into the ground, the audience at the racetrack earlier, late last year. So while I understand their mentality that they're trying to prove a point, maybe we need to take a little step back from that technique and let's do it the right way. And clearly the public opinion is changing and we're doing the right things, but all it would take would be something dramatic to happen, and then we'll be back to square one.
Well, we've talked often about interesting applications for UAVs. And David, we saw one this week that really is one that I would not have imagined. This was also from Popular Mechanics.
Yeah. This week, of course, was South by Southwest. Unfortunately, last night they had a huge setback at the convention and our thoughts go out to those people. But South by Southwest is a social media technology conglomerate. I don't know how else to describe it. It's a convention for music, for social media, for technology. And Chaotic Moon, which is a organization that likes coming up with interesting ideas and demonstrates technology, came up with a hexacopter that they're calling Cupid, who's capable of shooting things. Cupid stands for Chaotic Unmanned Personal Intercept Drone. Unlike our normal Cupid, this drone doesn't really show love. It shows you a lot of electricity, like 80,000 volts via a taser dart.
Yeah, this is, I'm not sure what the motivation. I can see this as maybe something that the police force might find useful. I'm not exactly sure, but I don't know if I like the idea of drones flying around shooting tasers at people, armed drones shooting tasers. I'm not sure that, you've got the accuracy level there that you'd have with a police officer firing a taser at close range. But it kind of is an interesting demonstration. I think it gets people's attention, that's for sure.
Yeah, and according to the article, the intention was they are definitely not going to market this. They are not going to offer it up to police forces or something. But they just wanted to spark a conversation about what a hobbyist, in quotes, in the real world could do. It's kind of a warning, kind of a discussion. It's more of a publicity stunt, but it definitely brings a darker side to UASs and UAVs. It might be a potential life-saving UAV for police. If you're thinking of some kind of long-range standoff, maybe having the drone fire the tape. It's just, and we don't normally like promoting this stuff, but it's definitely interesting in thinking out of the box, which we always like.
Right. And then we have another example of that. And this is something that conservationists are starting to look at.
Yeah, counting crows. No. Counting your chickens before they hatch? No. But counting cranes. This was from increasinghumanpotential.org, and it's using UAVs to track birds or avian populations.
Yeah, of course, that's an important part of wildlife study. And sometimes that's difficult because if you're doing things like counting populations, let's say when birds are roosting, that can be fairly difficult to manually start counting birds. So there's an organization that was formed. It's called conservationdrones.org. And what they're looking to do is sort of exploit the potential of unmanned aerial vehicles for conservation-related applications all across the world.
Yeah, and this was an interesting project because they needed to figure out how to count the cranes because they're moving targets. And the best time to count them would be at night and when they're in the water. But they had to make sure they stayed still so you could actually make an accurate count. So what they did was they flew the drones over, and the drones at range didn't disturb them during the day. So then at night, they took infrared photographs of it. And interestingly enough, and this is one of the most interesting parts of the article, was the birds are actually colder than the water that around them. So they show up as heat sinks. And since they're not disturbed and they're sleeping quietly, you can go along and count the little black dots and you get an accurate count of how many cranes are there. and then you can start folding your paper, Japanese origami, and make your little cranes to match them. It's a really neat technique, and it provided a highly accurate count, more so than normal. It didn't disturb the cranes, and it was... they met their objective. So good use of drones. And maybe we need to hunt down conservationdrones.org and see if we can get them on the show.
Yeah, it looks like an interesting organization. And they are always looking for support, contributions. And really what they're trying to do is help conservationists, particularly in countries that are underdeveloped, that really can't afford to go out and buy expensive quadcopters or multicopters, help them develop, build their own, and get these things up there flying in ways that can help conservationists. So it's worth taking a look at. All right, David, have we got a video of the week?
Bill sent us a video of the most insane rope swing ever, a canyon cliff jump. What was really neat about this video was it's really kind of cool, but the other thing about it was cinechopper.com also showed us another video with behind the scenes on how they filmed it with an octocopter with a three-axis gimbal, first-person view, and so it's an interesting pair of videos. And we keep getting a lot more videos, so we like everyone sending them in. Following that, since that came from Bill, we should go into our listener mail. And Max, our mailboxes are starting. I think they found out our email address.
Someone's discovered it, yes, because we are getting a lot of email, which is great.
Just so you know, folks, if we don't answer you right away, don't worry. We do read everything. We've had a tradition from Airplane Geeks of reading everything. It's just sometimes it comes fast and furious, and we can't always keep up with it. But definitely don't stop sending it in. And that's feedback@theuavdigest.com.
Now, Bob Iverson sent us a link. This is from a Wall Street Journal article, Drones Find Fans Among Farmers and Filmmakers. And one of the things I found particularly interesting, David, was talking about how drones are used in agriculture across the world. And here's an interesting statistic. I had no idea that apparently 40%, fully 40% of Japan's rice fields are sprayed by unmanned helicopters.
It was one of those stats that you sort of read multiple times and you go, really? Definitely Japan, as far as agriculture or drone agriculture goes, they're definitely ahead of the curve of us here in the States if 40% of their fields are sprayed by unmanned helicopters. Right. So we also heard from Trevor, who actually sent an email to the Airplane Geeks, but we moved over here. And his question was more about the quadcopters and drones and when do they become radio-controlled aircraft and stuff. And we got into a bit of a conversation with him, and believe it or not, Canada actually has a rule set up about what makes a model aircraft. A model aircraft means an aircraft with the total weight which does not exceed 35 kilograms, 77 pounds, that is mechanically driven or launched into flight for recreational purposes, and it's not designed to carry persons or other living creatures. So I guess I should never have put that field mouse in my radio-controlled airplane when I was a child.
Did you do that? I tried that with a model rocket.
So we've both violated Canada's rules. But although some micro-unmanned air vehicles weigh less than 35 pounds, they are operated by research institutions and other organizations for non-recreational purposes. So interesting there, Max, is no matter what it is, if you're using it for recreational purposes, you're good. But you start using it for commercial uses, not so good.
And Trevor sent some interesting links concerning the perspective of UAVs in Canada, and we'll be sure to put those in the show notes.
Last but not least, from our new absurd collection, man arrested over drone drugs drop. This is another story from Down Under. So evidently, a man attempted to smuggle drugs and a mobile phone with a drone into a maximum security Melbourne remand center in Ravenhall. There's been a lot of alliterations in that article.
Yeah, sure.
And Rob Coates sent us that. And Rob, believe it or not, this is the second story we had this. We had a story about this in Florida in one of our earliest episodes where they were trying to smuggle drugs over the wall with drones, and I still haven't quite figured out how someone thinks that that's not going to be glaringly obvious with guys walking a wall to notice a DJI Phantom coming up and over and think that it's not going to get noticed.
Right. It didn't work in either of the two cases that we're aware of.
I'm sure third time's a charm, right, folks?
Yeah.
Well, Max, that was really a quick episode. Again, I want to thank you for doing that transcript.
My pleasure.
It was definitely made my life a little easier. Hopefully, folks definitely take the time and listen to it because it is important for our industry. So where can they find us, Max?
Well, you can find show notes at theuavdigest.com. We're also on Twitter @UAVDigest. Where else, David?
You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/UAV Digest, and that's rapidly becoming a thing. And you can find us on iTunes and Stitcher.com, where you can stream us directly from your mobile phone. And either place, if you like us, leave us feedback, because it gets us out in the world more so we can talk about it and spread the word that UAVs are good. And we have a Cafe Press store that we'll put in the show notes, and you can start buying UAV Digest swag.
Wow, that's all set up, David?
It's going to be a grow in progress, so we want people to go visit often. I haven't got the shot glasses up there, but the goal is to have our shot glasses to go with our FAA drinking thing. So, but you can get a UAV tumble to have a beer and some swag and maybe some iPhone covers and stuff. So there's stuff out there for you to look at. We're not going to make any money off of this stuff, folks, but for all intents and purposes, but it would be nice that you could show your friends that you do like UAVs. And I'm still working on our reformed dronophobe logos. Well, it's been a busy night here in Philly, so I'm going to sign off saying this is David in Philly.
And Max in Hartford.
Thanks for listening.